When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to this week's episode of the Elise Glink Show. I'm Elise Glink, and I'm here to help you make the best money moves possible. But first, here's my Glinkonomics report. A little later in the show, I'll be talking about appraisals with Lance Coyle. But here's a story from another appraiser that I know well, Jonathan Miller of Miller Samuel Appraisers in New York. He's been on our show before, and every week he writes a terrific newsletter, and he pointed out in his newsletter last week that 1978 was the first year that an apartment sold in Manhattan for more than $1 million. In today's dollars, that apartment would have cost a little over $3.5 million. No small number. However, the priciest co-op in Manhattan today, which is actually in the same building as that 1978 property, sold earlier this year for $77.5 million. All right, let's review that just quickly. $3 million, which is what it would have sold for in today's dollars, and $77.5 million. I wish I had bought that thing. So, why am I pointing this out? In my last two shows, I talked about stagnant wages and the declining value of a middle-class home. Clearly, $77.5 million is not a middle-class home. But if you've ever needed evidence that the wealthiest Americans are doing immensely better than the rest of us, this is the story to focus on. And just like with the lower end of the housing market, it all comes back to wages. The average CEO to worker compensation ratio was about 30 to 1 in 1978. In 2013, 300 to 1. That exponential increase in wages for top earners is a big reason luxury real estate has inflated so much in value and so much faster than the rest of the market. The other reason, of course, that this is happening is you've had huge money coming in from China, Russia, Latin America, all of it looking for a safe haven. And there are a few places safer than real estate in Manhattan, apparently, because look at how it's inflated in value. These folks who come in here from around the world are just looking for a place where it won't decline in value. But on top of it, it's inflating like crazy. In 1978, the median single-family home sale price was just a bit under $60,000. Adjusted for inflation, that's about $215,000. The average home sales price is almost 40% higher than that today. So owning a home has definitely been a good investment over the last 40 years. But in percentage terms, that co-op in Manhattan has gained an almost incomprehensible 2,200% jump in value after factoring out inflation. If that median value $60,000 home in 1978 had appreciated at that rate, it would be worth more than $4.6 million today, or more than that co-op would have been worth, the million-dollar co-op in 1978 that would only be worth a little over $3 million today. This other house would be worth more had it inflated at the same rate. Now, wouldn't you just love it if your home appreciated like that over the life of your mortgage? I know I would. All right, on to the rest of the show. So as I said earlier, my guest today is Lance Coyle. He's president of the Appraisal Institute. I'm going to be asking him about the latest news in the appraisal industry since he helms the largest professional association for real estate appraisers. He's also going to give us a few thoughts on how landscaping affects home values. In my mind, it's more important than ever before. We're going to talk about that. Then I'm going to answer a question from a couple selling an investment home. They're concerned about the tax hit they might be taking, and so they're looking around for a strategy to help them avoid that liability. I'll explain whether a 1031 tax-free exchange could help them and what you need to be careful of for if you're going to think about using one yourself. Then I'm going to wrap up the show with four home maintenance fire safety tips from the home organization site Homezada. All right, that's the lineup for today's show. Let's get going. This week, my guest is Lance Coyle. He's current president of the Appraisal Institute, which is the leading industry association for real estate appraisers. We're going to cover the gamut from consumer tips to challenging your appraisal to the how landscaping actually impacts your home value. Welcome to Big Money Real Estate, Lance.
Thank you.
So before we get into the tips that you have for consumers, let's talk about what's new or changing in the appraisal industry right now. What's going on with, say, drones?
Well, of course, that's a hot topic right now. Drones can be very useful for inspecting a property, looking at a large tract of land, for instance, or a large building. But there are many restrictions on the use of drones. And right now, it doesn't look like it's going to be very easy or convenient for appraisers to use that technology.
We just did a video shoot for a client, and one of the questions that came up was, did we want to actually use a drone? The cost of the drone for me to rent it for the day wasn't that expensive, but owning it is a serious investment. Is the investment part of it the problem with using drones for appraisals, or are there other legal restrictions such as FAA rules and restrictions?
My view is it's the legal restrictions. Investing in drone technology isn't cheap, but it's not prohibitive either. And I think a lot of appraisers are very interested in how they can utilize that technology. Clearly, there are some very beneficial reasons for having access to drone technology, but right now the legal restrictions are really what is holding everybody back.
It's interesting. All right, well, let's talk a little bit about challenging an appraisal. We know that when a bank, you apply for a loan, whether you're refinancing or doing a purchase of a home, the bank is going to order an appraisal, and sometimes that appraisal comes back. And with the new rules in place, sometimes you get an appraiser who has never been in your neighborhood before, has no history or knowledge of what's been going on in that neighborhood, frankly. And the appraisal comes back, and it's completely wrong with what's going on. Is it possible for consumers to challenge these appraisals today? Is it any easier than it used to be? And what would be your best tips for that?
Well, yes, you can challenge an appraisal. There's really two kinds of ways you can challenge that appraisal. The first would involve just simply factual errors. If the appraiser doesn't get the number of bedrooms right or the number of bathrooms right, or something that's clearly factually wrong, then you should contact the lender and ask for that to be corrected. In most instances, that's a very straightforward process. The lender will look at it, they'll go back to the appraiser, and they will ask the appraiser to correct any of those kinds of factual errors. Now, if you just don't like the opinion of value, then that's a little bit different. Challenging an appraisal because you don't like the opinion of value is a little tougher. You can always request a second appraisal to be performed, but you're more than likely going to have to pay the cost of that second appraisal.
But the way that the appraisal industry has really changed over the really since the housing crisis began in 2007 and 2008 has really done a disservice both to the appraisers who are in it and I think in a lot of ways to the homeowners. Forget about how the realtors are screaming about it, but you've got this whole idea that was supposed to protect consumers, what it's done is layer on more cost. And because there are fewer and fewer appraisers who are willing to work for, say, about half as much as they were before, you have less experienced, less knowledgeable appraisers who are coming in from 50, 70 miles away to do an appraisal and have no knowledge in the industry. How is your organization handling that, and how are you training these people?
Well, we are on top of that, and one of the initiatives that we have right now is to try to get Congress to take a look at the regulatory environment. What you've said is absolutely correct. Some of the reforms that were made in the Dodd-Frank law of 2010 are now proving to be less than good policy, less than functional for not only consumers and homeowners and even commercial property owners, but the appraisal profession as a whole. The Appraisal Institute has about 21,000 members, and that makes us by far the largest professional society of real estate appraisers around, by far. But we only represent about 30% of the wider real estate appraiser population in the United States. We have just under 80,000 appraisers in the United States. So we reach about 21,000 of those folks. Most of the folks that are not affiliated with us are in the residential mortgage lending market. And we encourage them to come and take our courses and our seminars, and many do, but some of them are out of reach for us in terms of how we train them. As far as the other things are concerned, we do have active conversations with our legislators, and we are working on some solutions to try to streamline and modernize federal regulations that we think have not been good for all parties around. And some of that has been having to do with appraisal management companies. Some of it has to do with the requirements on appraisers. We're making progress, we think, but it is a little bit slow.
How is it being received over in Washington, D.C.?
Well, we think there's interest. We do talk to our congressman about this, and we do get a lot of interest in it. They are listening, and a number of folks that we've talked to are concerned about the environment, not only in Congress, but other trade groups as well. You mentioned earlier that the number of appraisers has been declining in the United States.
Right.
And in fact, we're down about 20,000 appraisers in the last 8 years or so. We've had about a 20% decline. Much of that is due to the regulatory environment, in our view. There are a number of reasons why that is, but the regulatory environment certainly has not helped with that. And as a result of that, the bankers' associations and others are concerned about the availability of appraisers going forward. And we're concerned about it as well.
Are you working with the Appraisal Foundation on this?
Well, the Appraisal Foundation is authorized by Congress to set qualifications and standards for real estate appraisers in the United States. We left as a sponsor of that organization back in 2010, so we don't really work with them very much. Being the largest professional association of appraisers in the United States, we have enough of a footprint that we can speak directly to Congress, and of course, we'll bring in anybody that wants to join us from other parts of the profession.
All right. Let's turn a little bit to some tips for consumers. One of the things that I think has a tremendous impact on a home value, particularly now that we're in the age of digital viewing, where people will make offers regularly on property that they haven't even seen it. This blows my mind every time I hear somebody doing this. However, the value of landscaping on home values has skyrocketed. Your house has to look amazing in a photograph of the exterior. Nobody's ever even going to make an appointment to see it. We've been doing these sort of what I call drive-by showings, where people will drive lot line to lot line, and if they like it in the 30 seconds or 20 seconds or 5 seconds, depending on how wide that is, to get across the property, they like how it looks, then they might actually call the realtor. So landscaping has become something that's, you know, even more important than physically protecting the exterior of the house, but it's this thing that is really make it or break it on an instantaneous impact. So that's my view of it. What are you seeing from an appraisal point of view on the impact of landscaping on home values, and what should consumers be thinking about as they are thinking about changing the hardscape of their landscape?
Well, you're correct about all of those things. When a consumer drives by a house, the first thing that they notice is the exterior appearance of that house. And of course, landscaping has a lot to do with it. And consumers will form an instantaneous impression about that home before they ever go inside. So you're absolutely correct. The initial impression that consumers get from the exterior of the house is all important in terms of marketing the house and getting people to come inside. Now, what consumers need to know about marketing that house is that that landscaping has got to be tidy. It can't seem overgrown. The lawn needs to be mowed. The bushes need to be trimmed. The landscaping needs to appear like it's well kept. You just can't have a lot of overgrown stuff, and you can't have a lot of drab looking landscaping. The old adage that realtors have been pushing for years, that if you just put some pretty colorful flowers out front, you'd be surprised at how much it makes a difference in terms of generating interest in the house. So getting it tidied up, making it look good, are really important. Now, it can affect the value of the home. If you have poor landscaping that needs to be ripped out and, you know, you need to start over, then certainly a consumer is not going to want to pay as much for that home because they know they'll have the expense of redoing the landscaping. So good landscaping, bad landscaping, certainly it can affect the value of the home.
Yeah, I absolutely believe that. And, of course, people are just don't even want the headache of doing anything to their homes anymore. They just want to move in and have it be perfect and look like it's an HGTV set, strangely enough. Lance, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate your comments.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
On today's episode, I've got an answer for a couple hoping to take advantage of a 1031 exchange. Here's the question they asked. What are the best strategies to minimize the tax liability on a rental sale? We bought a single-family home, lived in it for a couple of years, then rented it for the last 6 years. We'd like to sell it, but we're concerned about a hefty tax bill. We also own another house that we use as our office. Can we roll the gain from the first property to pay down the note on the office property? Here's the answer. The rental property this couple once used as a home is now considered an official investment property by the IRS because they haven't lived in it for the last 5 years. With an investment property, you can either pay the capital gains taxes owed upon the sale of the property, or you can defer them using Section 1031 of the tax code, hence the term 1031 exchange. It allows a property owner to sell that property and defer paying taxes upon the sale if the, and that's a big capital if the property owner sets up a tax-deferred exchange, also called a like-kind exchange or Starker exchange, Starker Trust. But Section 1031 only applies if you sell a property and then buy a replacement property or replacement multiple properties with some constraints in that order. You could do a reverse 1031 where you sell first and then you buy, or buy first and then you sell. But in either words, you have to actually decide what order it's all going to happen in. Unfortunately, this couple won't be able to use the property they already own to obtain a tax-deferred exchange. If they decide to buy something new, they would. There are other constraints to consider as well. The value of the replacement property or properties must have a value equal to or greater than the property that's being sold. Plus, like-kind exchanges have strict term limits or time limits for purchasing the replacement property. You have 45 days to choose the new property or identify it and 180 days to close from the time of sale. There are some instances where the 180-day window may shrink, but in any case, you never get to go beyond it. Upon the sale of the investment home, you'd have to set up an exchange through a company that specializes in 1031 exchanges. All proceeds from the sale of the property would then be transferred into a trust that's held by that company, so you as the owner never touch the money. Really important part of that. Just make sure that you choose a knowledgeable and reputable 1031 exchange company. There are a lot of frauds out there, and there are a lot of people, even attorneys, will do 1031 exchanges. But there have been all sorts of fraud cases over the years where even attorneys turn out to be spending the money for their own private jets. Not what you want, because, again, if you blow the 180-day time limit, and you can't get the money back, you will owe taxes to the IRS on any profits for the sale of the property. So not only do you not defer the profits, you then have to pay tax on the profits, and you may then still be liable to buy the property, the new property, as well, and you'll have no cash with which to do it. So choose that 1031 company very, very carefully. I've got four maintenance tips that can protect your home from fire hazards, courtesy of HomeZada. For those of you who may not already be familiar with HomeZada, it's a digital hub that provides online tools to help you organize all the information about your home, including your home maintenance schedule. And when it comes to these four maintenance tips, the reminder could be a lifesaver. First, test the batteries in your smoke alarms. For those of you who may have missed my previous report on hidden home hazards, you need to know that there's more than one type of smoke detector. Photoelectric smoke detectors will detect smoke in your home more quickly than ionization smoke detectors, according to the International Association of Firefighters. So after checking batteries, be sure to replace any ionized smoke detectors in your home with photoelectric detectors instead. And one more note on that. You may not even realize it, but smoke detectors die after about 5 years. So at the end of 5 years, give it away and go buy a new one. And yes, you have to put a new battery in the new one as well. But smoke detectors don't last forever. And if there are any in your house that are older than 10 years, out. You just want to get rid of them because your life could be at stake. Next, you should clean out your dryer vent. This isn't just about pulling out that screen from your dryer and like scraping out the lint and tossing that. You also need to clean the built-up lint out of the pipe that vents hot air from your dryer out of your home to prevent the possibility of a fire starting there. The hot air that comes out of the dryer, that exhaust, is so hot it can ignite any of the lint or other pieces of debris that come out of your clothing, and that is super dangerous. Third, make sure that any fire extinguishers in your home haven't expired. This is another thing you have to watch for, because fire extinguishers should last a long time, but you have to check to make sure that they're going to work when you need them, right? And you need to check in advance. So make sure the needle indicating the pressure is in the green zone. Then do a quick check to be sure the pin is still in, the handle is on tight, and the hose doesn't have any cracks or holes in it. While you're at it, take a quick look at the instructions if you don't already know how to use a fire extinguisher, and be sure you know where the fire extinguishers are in your house. You should have one in your kitchen, right? That's where a lot of fires take place. One up in your laundry room or down in your laundry room, depending on where it is, and one by an exit so that you can be sure to get out fast and have a fire extinguisher really handy. We've got two in our kitchen, one upstairs in the laundry, and then down in the basement as well. And I think we actually even have one in our bedroom. My husband asked me the other day, and I'm like, I think there's one in the bedroom too. He goes, right. All right, here's the last tip from HomeZada. You've got to get your chimney cleaned, especially if you're going to use your fireplace this winter, and especially if you've got a wood-burning fireplace. You're going to want to make sure your chimney is free of all the soot and ash and junk, which builds up over time and eventually could catch fire or even, and this is really extreme, but happens, explode if it's left in there. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Thanks again to Lance Coyle from the Appraisal Institute for being a guest on the show. If there was anything you missed, you never have to worry. You can find the show notes to this episode at thinklink.com, thinklink.com. And, of course, we always tweet it out. I'm at Glink, at GLINK. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes if you haven't already. Give us a show rating or review while you're there. You can also check out my other podcasts by searching for Monday Morning Marketing with Elise Glink and John Burns on iTunes or just in Google. What we do on that podcast every week is give you some extra marketing, PR, and social media advice. We would love to have you give us a rating or review and share it around with your other business owner friends. You can find a link to it on my digital content agency website, thinklinkmedia.com, thinklinkmedia.com. All right, that's the end of another episode of The Elise Glink Show. I'm still your host, Elise Glink. I'll be back with another new episode next week as well. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great week.